and welcome to the Velvet Studio.
The Velvet Studio.
Yeah, Canada's Queer Media. I thought of that up again. We're now Canada's Queer Media. Not just Ottawa. Canada.
All of Canada.
Every little bit. Northwest Territories, we're the Queer Media.
Cool. Not that island in Greenland that may or may not be Danish, but is probably ours, but it also might be Danish.
Well, it depends on what day of the week it is. So
history's most friendly territorial dispute.
It is
actually on record as being history's most friendly territorial dispute.
They keep
giving
each other's gifts. It was a very entertaining video, I think, about that.
They leave Canadian Naval Guard leave. That's the Navy who are the guard of the ocean, not guards who guard navals. And they leave, what is it? They leave Crown Royal whiskey in a Canadian flag, and then the Danes leave schnapps in a Danish flag or something like that.
They just keep swapping.
Yeah.
Which is hilarious. I wonder if the Navy has an actual budget for, like...
for whiskey? For Canadian whiskey?
For territorial disputes with the Danes. Oh my gosh.
It'd be the cheapest territorial dispute in history as well,
then.
This is
true.
Because it's just a bottle of whiskey twice a week.
This is true.
As opposed to, like, an ambassador.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, for sure. So we are still in the throes of Refugee Month.
Oh. usually when somebody says we're in the throes of blank, I think labor.
I was thinking pleasure, and I'm like, well, yeah, we could be in the throes of pleasure for this. I think this is quite a pleasurable experience discussing... refugees.
Well, we seem to be in the throes of giving birth to the topic of
we haven't really
something
got that far yet. So in about 17 minutes,
okay,
give or take,
uh-huh,
we will be talking with Nick Hirsch, who is a immigration lawyer.
Okay.
And very, very interesting man.
Yes.
And he'll be talking to us about, really the question is, how do you prove that you were a homosexual? Yeah, yeah, it's...
Do I look like I need to prove it?
No, you're currently fanning yourself with a fan that has daisies on it, so I'm like...
Those are cherry blossoms, aren't
they? Oh, I am terribly sorry. I am terribly, terribly sorry that I mistook your daisy thing.
And it's a masculine fan as well, I'll have you know.
Of course, of course.
From the men's section.
There's a cherry blossom fan in the men's section.
Well, yeah, because it's... Okay, so I bought this when I lived in Japan in the department store. They actually... Folding fans are pretty common there. Everybody has them because in the summer it gets pretty gross there. Actually, it's about the same... You know early August where Ontario was basically 3 inches from the surface of the sun?
Yeah, yeah, give or take a half inch.
Yeah, yeah, that was a normal sort of Japanese summer, and so they've long since adapted to it. And so folding fans are not considered effeminate there. And these cherry blossoms are white and red instead of pink and another shade of pink.
Mm.
And they're also blocky shaped, and they're on a navy background.
Wait, are they blocky? Oh, yeah, they're kind
blocky,
of geometric. Yeah. That makes it masculine.
Yeah, so it's pink is not considered an effeminate color in Japan. It's just there's traditionally feminine and masculine ways of depicting different flowers. I don't know how. Well, I mean, it's just as weird as any culture, really. I mean, the fact that floral patterns in pink are considered effeminate in the West is no less weird than the fact that they have masculine and feminine ways of depicting cherry blossoms. It's all equally weird.
This is true. We don't want to, discriminate the degrees of weirdness.
But this is way off topic.
Yeah, a little
sorry,
bit, which is fine.
My fault.
Which is fine because it gives me a second to prep, prep the
surgery.
When prepping the surgery, that's exactly what I was going to say, because that's what we do here. Oh, that reminds me.
You're getting surgery.
No, I'm not getting surgery. We're going on Facebook Live, so you can both. See us and hear us and on all sorts. We thought we'd try this out as a new interactive tool.
What on earth is Facebook Live?
Although it might just be me being the tool. So this is...
I feel like I'm learning right now.
Yeah, let's type it in. If you're on Facebook and follow any of us, this could be an exciting opportunity. Go live. Apparently it's counting me down. This is interesting. We're live on lots of things right now.
Okay.
Yeah, lots of live happening. So there we go. There's Sebastian. Yeah.
Why are you showing them my picture?
I don't know. It seemed appropriate. Anyway, back to the topic at hand. We were going to talk about... we leave the conversation around the immigration stuff to Nick when he gets here. Mm-hmm. Because we'll be calling him in just a few minutes. But in the meantime, I read an interesting article. Surprise, surprise, civil marriages have been dropping like a stone. Oh, sorry, civil partnerships have been dropping like a stone.
Now that legal marriage is permitted?
Now that legal marriage is permitted. I feel like this is just more evidence to show that that folks who engage in a legal coupling of some sort, you know, they're not, you know, civil partnership is almost second fiddle to civil marriage. But we all knew that.
Yeah.
At least now we're seeing the statistical evidence to kind of show that that's the case.
That people wanted full marriage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would get gay married or gay civil partnered. Or just like civil partnered and married.
Jake, are you listening?
This is... I think he only wants to marry me for my immigration status. I'm not going to lie. Like that.
But I thought you were
British
still...
passport. Yeah.
Oh, I thought you were still working on that.
Yeah, yeah.
You're still a landed immigrant, aren't you?
No, I'm a permanent resident.
Permanent resident? I thought you were... Wait, what was the...
Why are we discussing my immigration status live, like, on radio? Like, what? What? It is relevant, actually, because we are talking about immigration and immigration
Yeah,
refugee board.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, even with a British passport, you don't just show up. You're like, I'm Canadian now.
No. Not since the good old days of colonialism.
1800 which, and something.
Yeah, which we don't recommend colonialism. It's not healthy.
Not generally.
Yeah.
Actually, we mentioned that last week.
We did, yes.
Some of the
you casually described...
historically complicated situations which cannot be described in less than 20 minutes without doing it a disservice. Like the way that I described the handing over of the Congo from Belgium to the Congolese was basically, right, we're done, see you later, which is... very reductive.
Absolutely.
But it did happen in something like less than a month, and that was that did not go well, and
there were some, you know, when it comes to colonization, there were some that were particularly adamant. The Brits were pretty keen on stealing shit.
Yeah.
Pardon my cursing.
You're Welsh.
But they were pretty keen on just like, you know, this patch of land, that's now mine. Yeah. I'm just going to keep that. All you folks living there, tough.
If you look at the colonial history of the French, they're really divided between, like, the worst of the worst and, like, really not that bad. Like, there's a few colonies where they would show up and they're like, oh, we just want your sugar. Whatever you're doing, just keep doing it. Just give it to us and we'll pay you for it. And they're like, but you're paying for it, so it's not slavery? They're like, no, you don't get to vote or leave or run for government or get an education. But, you know, you're within the borders. Mm. You're totally free to do whatever you want. Just give us your sugar. And it was this weird kind of like, not great, but...
I think we've ended up in a reductive conversation about colonialism again.
We should.
Yeah, that happens.
But again, like, unless you're taking like an 8-semester long course on it.
Wow. So we got some feedback here. Jake says, marry the white man and green card. I feel like, you know, I think that's a thing that's happening. And then we've had some... and our friend Stefan, who you know, said, wow, Facebook Live, hashtag behind the times. That is inappropriate hand gestures.
Whatever.
Which you obviously can't tell. So we're going to play this song. It's called Sia. It's by Sia. It's not called Sia.
It's by Sia.
Yeah. And now this station has a bit of an embargo on Top 40. Rightly so. Top 40 is kind of annoying.
Why didn't you just play Sia from 2012 before she made it big in North America? Like, clap your hands
But this one is about it's one of a string of songs that have come out in the last few years. About the Pulse shooting.
Oh. Okay.
And it's actually a really good kind of like self-empowerment themed song. Now, I'm not for kind of like grief, like capitalizing on grief and trauma. And we've seen a lot of artists do this. And most of them have been GLBT artists kind of expressing themselves.
I think one of the few cases where it totally made sense was Elton John with Princess Diana, but they were actual friends
Yeah.
who actually spent quite a bit of time together. And that time did not, and it's really weird because it was kind of acceptable because they did know each other and it wasn't just him capitalizing on it.
Yeah.
It made it okay, and that kind of opened the floodgates to everything else happening, and now there's tribute songs all the time.
We could do a whole CD on just, like, Crest. Pulse shooting tribute songs.
Oh, okay.
Songs.
I mean, you could also do it, like, we could run an entire show on Crass cover songs in general.
Oh,
do they know it's Christmas?
Oh, wow. Oh, my God.
My favorite counter-argument, there was an ambassador from, I think it was Libya, who's like, we're not stupid, we're poor.
Yeah.
Yes, we know it's Christmas. You forced Christianity on us, thank you very much.
Yeah. Do they know a gentle reminder of colonialism? Like, that's, you know, it's FYI. Anyway, back to this song. We'll be back just after this. And let us know what you think. I got stamina. Oh, running out, I close my eyes. Well, oh, I got stamina. And oh, I see another mountain to climb. But I got stamina. Oh, I need another lover of mine. Because I got stamina. Hello and welcome back to the Velvet Studio, home of Ottawa's queer media. And we are talking about today's show is episode 2 of Refugee Month.
Right.
And the idea is that we're talking about, you know, all sorts of things. Last week we had Michael Casasola in from the United Nations HCR. What is that? High Commission for Refugees?
Yeah.
Is that it? You know, we spent half the show last week discussing the fact that I can never remember what their name is.
Yeah.
Like, I never know
what
they're called.
That's fine.
Which is really annoying, but whatever.
Part of the reason why Part of the motivation for doing Refugee Month, we should probably mention that as well, because yeah. I don't think we ever prefaced the whole thing.
Yeah, why are we doing Refugee Month?
It was back at the beginning of summer where you and I were planning ahead on topics to do in the following months, and I said, well, we haven't really talked about refugees as much as we could.
Mm-hmm.
And something that I find very interesting, because I've seen this happen on several occasions, where people... Hello, live streamers who are watching me and all my awkwardness. I'm not even wearing my shirt. I can't, anyway, it doesn't matter. I'm not naked. I just have another shirt to put on top of this shirt mm-hmm. that looks much nicer.
But for the sake of the listeners, he is naked. Anyway, carry on.
That a lot of people in countries that do not have LGBT projections, they move to Canada thinking of this as being like the Shangri-La, like the place where they can finally come mm-hmm. out and be open and be free and be comfortable and not be judged and not be harassed and not have to fear being sent to jail or worse. And then they get here and then they run into the usual refugee problems, language barriers, financial barriers, social barriers. Sometimes there's cultural barriers. Mm-hmm. Something that's considered standard in your home country is considered rude in the country you're going to, or vice versa, or you just don't know how to talk to people. And there's a long list. And so they a lot of LGBT refugees or even just immigrants
yeah.
will come to Canada and they completely and totally feel alienated from their home culture, which even though there's diaspora all over Canada, diaspora, you know, we use academic terms all the time and I like to remind you to define them, and I just noticed I
yeah,
should.
Yeah, you just did.
Yeah, I just did.
And so I was about to call you out there, but then you were like, I need to do this thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So like, Chinatown is like the Chinese diaspora. It's like a community away from home.
Said community,
from,
yeah.
Yeah. And it's usually sort of scattered, but it doesn't have to be scattered. Sometimes it's sort of just inherently scattered. So in a very, very technical sense, Hawaiians are diasporic of Indonesians plus 1,000 years. Their languages, they speak the same language.
Okay.
Sort of. I mean, in that case, you're just talking about human migration.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is, like, anyway, that's, I mean, diaspora is step one
yeah.
to human migration and to okay. things spreading. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Yeah, no, he's laughing at me.
Yeah,
the camera's
bit.
Pointed at me, not him, and so you can't see his faces. Anyway, point being, right, so the different issues that a lot of LGBT refugees and immigrants have when they come to Canada, sometimes they're not really spoken about. This idea that, you know, you're a gay man, you come to Canada, you just join the gay community. That's how it is, right? That's how it goes.
Yeah, except for all of the, what's that word, racism.
Racism, yeah. So, I mean, and really weird assumptions. So, like, if you are a Russian refugee, a young gay male refugee, people just assume you're just going to find yourself a daddy and settle down in someone's house, and then that'll take care of it, right? Because you're just like a male version of a Russian order bride, and it's like, whoa, hold on, okay?
Let's take a few minutes to deconstruct all of those stereotypes.
Every single, yeah, but these are things that if you go on some of the discussion sites like Reddit or Tumblr or Whisper, which we use quite a bit here on the show. And
yeah.
I saw some of your whispers, by the way. I could tell they were you. People do think in these ways. And in some cases, it's not necessarily because they're horrible people. Half the time, it's just this sort of thing isn't discussed.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really brought up. There's no real resource. There's not a lot of, you know, tell-all autobiographies about someone who came to Canada and then realize they had to relearn what it meant to be gay, or trans or lesbian or what have you, while also adapting to Canada, while also dealing with refugee issues. Like, there's paperwork involved,
yeah.
and like
yeah.
it's bananas, and it's just it's not really discussed very often. I was like,
you know, you mentioned that, you know, perhaps we should talk about this, and I was like, you know, you're absolutely right. This is definitely worth a conversation, but I wasn't as convinced that it was worth
an entire month?
Yeah, until I went to a panel conversation.
Oopsies.
And they had 4 or 5 different panelists, and that panel seemed to just talk about things with such a depth and breadth that I was like, yes, this is absolutely...
And height. The dimensions.
Yeah, all the dimensions. You know, the time and space continuum measurements were ridiculous. But no, they discussed the topic with enough variety that I'm like, you know what, we could probably make a decent conversation on this quite easily.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're going to call Nick, and hopefully he is ready for our phone call.
He's ready to receive.
But would you like to introduce the song whilst we give that call?
I know why. It's because you can't read French. This is Drapeau Blanc from Cœur de Pirate. They're based out of Montreal, but they're not actually from Montreal. I believe they're, one of them is from Paris and one of them is from Quebec City, but they're based out of Montreal. I might be making this up. You can call me out on this.
And the lady recently identified as bisexual.
Actually, do you know who could correct us on this? Somebody who knows the music scene very well in the area. And that's Scott, the keyboardist and occasional accordion player.
Yes, of the Peptides, who have a new album out.
Yes, who is apparently a listener, and we keep forgetting to say hello to him.
Yeah.
He's a really nice guy. You should say hi. If you know him, say hello, Scott.
And Google the Peptides. They're a good, fun band. Anyway, we'll be back just after this.
Tandis qu'on se perd dans ses voisins, valide ces instants qu'on perd à force de construire le vide étreinte qui ne se tienne que de raison. Et chaque dit que j'abandonne, j'en ai.
Hello and welcome back, and we have Nick on the line. How are you doing? Oh, maybe I turned the wrong line.
Just turn them all up. What you usually
sometimes
do.
It goes to a different. Oh,
that's a bad sign.
Oh, I'm pretty sure we have him on the line. Yeah, extension one. Yep. Hello.
You're pressing buttons that aren't doing anything.
Well, that's annoying. all right. You know what we're gonna do. We are going to fix this because that's what we do best. And whilst we figure out how to get that line, Nick is on the line. He's definitely on the phone. I was just speaking to him, barely a moment ago. We're going to be listening to the song "Falling for You" by Leon Hart whilst we get this fixed. It's actually, if you have a chance to check it out, it is a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful music video that really accurately, in many ways, more accurately than other music videos, depicts a gay relationship. So definitely worth checking out. And it's also a very nice song. And we'll actually get this rolling in just a couple of seconds.
Still think you're frozen. You fooled me once before, but now I'm falling for you all over again. Falling for you. to play your marches. The dancer you say no more. Is there some way that I could stop the music? No. Skip through all your fires, climb into your palm. I swore I'd never let you steal pieces out of me again. If I break down, will you still leave me broken? Fool me once before, but now I'm falling for you.
Hello and welcome back to the Velvet Studio, and I believe we now have Nick on the line. How are you doing?
Good. How are you, Luke?
Oh, fantastic. Thank you, of course, to the station manager here for helping fix that for us. Massive lifesaver. We were certainly struggling a little bit, but all is well now. You know, sometimes it just boils down to things being on, like, you know, an A instead of a B, or, you know, zero instead of a one. You know, these things happen. It's cool. Anyway, we wanted to talk to you about how do you prove to the Immigration and Refugee Board, because, of course, you know, the process is, if somebody makes a refugee claim, at some point someone's going to ask them to prove it, in theory. So what's that process like, and how does one, or how would one prove their sexuality?
That's a good question, and the short answer is you can't prove it. You know, sexuality is something that's so complex and so fluid that I think even in, you know, in North American culture, it's something we still don't fully understand. So when it comes to a refugee claim, obviously, as you're alluding to, it's quite a challenging barrier for sexual and gender minority refugee claimants. Under Canada's refugee legal system, there is what's called a presumption of truthfulness unless there are serious doubts. That means that an adjudicator can't simply walk into a hearing and immediately be dismissive or dubious of a claimant's allegations that they're lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or another sexual or gender identity. That being said, the reasons why board members or adjudicators may doubt your credibility, I think, are quite alarming. One of the big challenges for all refugees is, you know, simply accessing Canada's immigration system. So many of them come here, they don't speak English or French, they're suffering from mental health afflictions. They need to find a lawyer, they need to find a settlement agent, they need to find housing. So these are all, you know, typical experiences for refugees when they come to Canada and try to make a refugee claim here. But for sexual and gender minority refugees, unlike other ones, they're an invisible minority group. So for them, you know, they don't trust the ethno-cultural community that they come from. They don't necessarily want to meet with a lawyer or a settlement agent that speaks their language or shares their background. So for them, sometimes the first time they're really talking about their sexuality may be at the hearing, and that's a very scary experience. You know, I think for many people that are LGBT, even here in Canada, we all remember what a stressful experience is to first, you know, put words to describing who we truly are. And for people that come from a background where, or a country where, they could face persecution on account of who they are, it's very scary for them to first come to Canada, and that will be the first opportunity they have to explain who they truly are. So, even though there is this presumption of truthfulness, if a claimant is evasive or isn't spontaneous or isn't articulating themselves in a way that's palatable to an adjudicator, that adjudicator may in turn disbelieve the person's credibility. You know, one example I can give is a claimant that is okay answering questions about, you know, their name, where they're from, what their family situation is, but then once it comes to questions about when they realize their sexual orientation or if they've had sexual relationships, then they become very hesitant. And what adjudicators don't necessarily consider is whether that evasiveness or that elusiveness is due to mental health barriers that the sexual or gender minority refugee claimant is facing.
And by that you mean trauma?
Right, maybe.
I do mean trauma. Well, okay. PTSD is certainly one of the major mental health barriers for LGBT refugee claimants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they did express or have their sexual orientation revealed and were subsequently persecuted because of it, you know, like many gay refugees will face physical violence, they'll face severe discrimination. For lesbian and bisexual women, they may have experienced corrective rape as a, you know, means of, you know, supposedly changing their sexual orientation. And for them to reveal those experiences, even if they're in a safe place like Canada, is still very, very difficult. So certainly PTSD is one of them. Another major mental health barrier is internalized homophobia. So this means someone that, you know, does recognize the fact that they are attracted to someone of the same gender, but they disavow those feelings, they disassociate themselves with other sexual minorities. They may not espouse the term LGBT, not because they're not familiar with it, but because they just don't want to be associated with that term or that community.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are serious feelings of stigma and shame surrounding their own sexual identity. Mm-hmm. So those may be other reasons why someone may not be so articulate in a hearing.
Could there also be issues of fear of having to prove it?
Now, there's that too.
I mean, the whole refugee status determination process is very stressful for all refugee claimants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my job as the lawyer is to elicit those experiences they had in their home country and their fears in case of return.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it is uncomfortable not only for me to ask those questions, but for them to answer, because really I'm just a complete stranger to them. You know, I explain to them that, you know, this is part of the requirements to prove that they're a refugee, is to tell their story and to help build up their confidence and level of comfort so they can articulate that story to a board member. But you're absolutely right that that story has to come out. Mm-hmm. And an adjudicator can't necessarily read between the lines or just kind of insinuate that the person had suffered persecution or would suffer persecution in case of return to their home country.
In the UK, the Home Office recently told the asylum seeker and caseworkers, which I think would be a rough equivalent, that they can mm-hmm. ask for explicit details regarding GLBT claimants. So they can't ask you about sex lives, but they still want to know things like, you know, what are the local gay clubs? You know, what's the mm-hmm. Pride community doing where you are? Do people get asked those kinds of questions here in Canada?
They absolutely do. I mean, I think my personal opinion is Canada is one of the more better countries at having a sensitive and fair refugee status determination process compared to other jurisdictions like the UK. But certainly there's kind of this misconception of what sexual and gender minority refugees will do once they arrive in Canada. There's this really well-known theory called the CAS model of sexual identity development. I don't know if you've heard of it. So her name was Vivian Carr. She was an Australian and she was an Australian psychologist that coined this identity formation model in Australia in the late 70s. And the idea is that sexual minorities go through linear stages in recognizing and espousing their sexual identity. So first is awareness that you may be attracted to the same gender, then follows that you're not like everyone else, so there's a sense of otherness that you are not heterosexual, you may be something other than that. And anyway, when you get to the latter stages of that model, you synergize your public and private sexual identity, mm-hmm. which I think to us means the idea of coming out, that you publicly disclose in certain contexts that you are a sexual minority. And then eventually, if you're comfortable enough, you will, spread your wings and fly and, like, go to the gay club. So there's this misconception that once sexual minority refugees arrive in Canada, they're ready to embrace what we consider to be a gay lifestyle. Mm. So that includes having same-sex relationships. That includes attending gay-related venues like organizations, associations, nightclubs, certainly telling friends of your sexual identity.
Going underground.
And at the most egregious is being promiscuous and having fleeting sexual encounters. And there are obviously several issues with this misassumption, I would say. One is, again, the mental health barriers. So simply because people are in a safe place like Canada does not mean, even if they wanted to embrace a sexual identity, doesn't mean that they have the willingness at that stage to be openly gay the way that we understand it. Mm-hmm. Secondly, you know, the idea of being LGBT is in itself a cultural concept. Many of my clients have never even heard of the term LGBT before they arrived in Canada. You know, often in their countries, there are other words, sometimes derogatory terms, to describe sexual minority sexuality. So for them to come to Canada and say, okay, well, now you're part of the LGBT community, their response is, I don't really know what that is.
A lot of LGBT people in Canada don't know what it means.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah. And again, because, you know, maybe internalized homophobia or just general discomfort, they don't want to join a community or they don't want to go to gay bars. Because it's just not something that they're interested in for whatever reason. And, you know, there are also religious aspects, too. You know, gay Muslims are still Muslim. They do not want to be around people drinking alcohol or associated with people that do that. And some gay refugees are homebodies, just like you and me, and they just want to watch Netflix on a Friday night and not go out. So, you know, based on the case law I've read and so the cases that have been decided by refugee adjudicators and by the federal court, there is still somewhat of this expectation that you need to embrace this lifestyle if you're able to do that. But it's important, both me as a lawyer and as the claimant, to explain, one, like, this is what gay people might do in Canada. Is this a lifestyle that you're interested in? And I always tell clients, like, if this is something you don't want to do, you absolutely do not need to do it. I think you just need to be able to explain why, if it's because you're not interested or you're still afraid that your family back at home or possibly even family or your community members here will find out. You know, I'm part of a group that sponsors refugees too from overseas, and we have some gay refugees that come from the Middle East, and they say, I don't want anyone in Ottawa or Canada more generally to know that I'm here or my sexual identity because, you know, my ethnoculture community is very close-knit, mm-hmm. and I'm afraid that if they find out, they may harm me in some way or tell my family back at home. And these are very real risks, you know, even once they're in Canada. So certainly, you know, I think it's important for adjudicators. I don't think it's wrong to necessarily pose those questions, but they can't ground their credibility findings mm-hmm. if someone doesn't carry out a lifestyle that meets what their preconceived notions of a gay lifestyle entails.
So I had a question about, you know, how can we possibly improve this scenario? I know that Sebastian runs Geek Out, which is a gay geek group. You know, maybe like a knitting circle or a, you know, something that is different. Like we have the Fun Runners here in Ottawa, which are, they just go running. I don't see how mm-hmm. that's fun, but like that's, I don't get it.
They sweat their bodies on purpose.
I know, weird.
Yeah.
You know, the point being, would something like that be possible options where it's kind of within the LGBT culture, but it's not, you know, matching in the Pride Parade or having a Grindr mm-hmm. account. Would that, does that help? These other kind of
It helps certain claimants. I can tell you at the Centertown Community Health Center in downtown Ottawa, there is a monthly meeting for LGBT newcomers to get together and just talk about the refugee status determination process if they're still in that pipeline, or just talk about what life's been like for them since arriving in Canada. But again, like I mentioned, some of them just don't want to, they just don't want to talk about their experiences back at home. They don't want to talk about their gay identity even once they're here in Canada. And, you know, on one hand, it's important to be respectful of that. Mm-hmm. But at the other hand, the refugee system is in a way a bit unfair, because even though there's this presumption of truthfulness, it's still important for, I mean, it's the onus of the refugee claimant to prove that they're a refugee. And that involves raising what allegations of fear they have and why they have those fears in case of return. And that necessarily would involve at some point speaking about who they are. So certainly if they're interested in joining these type of social groups, they certainly help. I do think we certainly need more of it, you know, kind of these therapeutic centers and counselors that are trained on issues facing LGBT newcomers. Does it ultimately help the refugee claimants? I think it certainly does if they're willing to access it. Obviously, if they're not willing to access it, it's hard to improve, you know, their chances of articulating at a hearing.
Is there any kind of training for folks who are members of these refugee boards around the topic?
Yep, absolutely. So for the past 15 years, actually a former professor of mine who unfortunately passed away last year, she was hired by the Immigration Refugee Board to provide training to board members, not only on how to properly question refugee claims, claimants who are alleging persecution based on their sexual orientation or gender identity, but how to review the country condition documentation, how to prepare the assessment, and how to ultimately determine the merits of a claim. So she was doing that for about 15 years. And the Immigration Refugee Board right now is preparing what are called chairperson's guidelines. So there are these guidelines that are available for other types of claims. And these guidelines essentially explain to board members how to properly adjudicate a claim. So right now, those don't exist in Canada. Actually, I don't think they exist in most jurisdictions. The UNHCR, which is the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, they did release guidelines for their staff members in 2012. So my impression is that the guidelines in Canada are going to largely replicate those. And they do reach out to stakeholders like myself and other experts on LGBT refugee law on how those guidelines should look. So certainly there's a great deal of willingness on behalf of the board to know how to do these claims. But, you know, I do think there also needs to be work. There's work to be done with the lawyers and with the settlement agencies mm-hmm. on how to properly assist these people in navigating the immigration process.
And you can't really just have, like, lawyers that specialize on – well, I mean, you could have lawyers that specialize on LGBT issues, but – basically what it means is, like, if you want to make an LGBT based claim as a refugee, then you go with this lawyer. But if you're not comfortable coming out at all, that's not going to wash.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. So it's a matter of, you know, I think sometimes the hardest step is just getting that person connected to someone that they trust. So, you know, sometimes in my practice, there are, you know, refugees that know me well and they say, look, I have this friend. He recently came out to me. He's still very nervous and ashamed or whatnot, but can you meet with him? And, you know, one of the biggest responsibilities as a lawyer, as a refugee lawyer, is building that sense of trust with your clients. And that goes for all refugees, LGBT or not. But, you know, for the LGBT ones that, again, are still feeling very uncomfortable and very sensitive about their experiences, it's so important to be able to meet with them and slowly but surely build that trust. And sometimes the way I do it is just meeting with them and just asking them in the beginning, like, relatively innocuous questions just so they get a sense of who I am. Mm-hmm. Sometimes if they do have a trustworthy person, we bring them not only to our client interviews, but sometimes they also come to the hearings as not to testify, but just to be there for emotional support. Yeah. Certainly, if a client is suffering from any mental health issues that may inhibit their ability to testify, then getting them to see a counselor or a therapist or psychologist, and not only having that person work with them to help build up their capacity to testify, but possibly also write a report explaining why this person may have difficulty testifying on certain experiences, and giving that report to the Immigration Refugee Board and ask for certain accommodations that could be made so that the person can fully would have the full opportunity to present their case.
Now, last week, we had Michael Casasola with UNHCR mm-hmm. come in, and he was telling us about how, in some cases, people are brought in through the government who are identified on the ground as LGBT. Now, mm-hmm. there's kind of an assumption here that they're already at least comfortable enough letting government officials know that if that's the route that they're using to come into Canada. So are there some examples of folks who identify from the get-go?
No, that's a very good question. So, yeah, as Michael Casasola probably told you, there are refugees that can be brought who are already recognized as refugees and who resettle in Canada either through what's called the government assistance program. So those are refugees that come that the government helps set them up here. They're privately sponsored refugees, which I'm deeply involved in as well. Yeah, so for these, necessarily they must have had to have alleged that they are LGBT and that they feared persecution on account of their sexual orientation or gender identity. So you're right in saying that to a certain extent, these resettled refugees must have acknowledged not only to themselves but to an immigration officer that they are, in fact, a sexual or gender minority. That being said, when they come here, they still suffer, in my opinion, the same mental health inhibitors as, you know, people that come here and once they arrive make their refugee claim. You know, we sponsor refugees that, you know, really suffer from PTSD, and even though they're comfortable saying to themselves that they're gay, you know, if ever they try to talk about their family or experiences back in their home country or transit country, you know, they break down emotionally. And again, that's something that they may never get over and still require therapy to help them carry out their lives here in Canada. You know, the cultural barriers are there too. You know, again, I think there's this assumption that once gay resettled refugees arrive, they are ready to embrace mm-hmm. a gay community. And, you know, my group, Capital Rainbow Refuge, we privately sponsor refugees. And one of the things we are always mindful of is that the refugees we sponsor may not, you know, want to hang out with us. You know, they are obviously appreciative of the fact that we're helping them, get a safe haven here in Canada, but they may not want to necessarily associate with us because we are a gay-identifying group. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's something that's okay. You know, again, just because you are gay does not mean you want to embrace a lifestyle similar to gay Canadians, which in itself is quite diverse, right? So, So you're right that the people that are resettled here had to have already disclosed their sexual identity, at least to a visa officer. Mm-hmm. You know, some of the refugees we sponsor, the only people they've ever disclosed it to is to us, who prepare the application to bring them here, and subsequently the Canadian Embassy or Visa Office. Otherwise, their families may not know, their immediate friends in the country they're currently living in may not know. You know, it's still quite a scary experience for them having to talk about who they truly are, even if they're coming here as a resettled refugee.
Now, I want to thank. I know that I understand, of course, that you have to get away, and we will be having Capital Rainbow Refuge coming in to speak with us in 2 weeks. I was taken aback actually when at a panel someone said, you know, how do I help? And they said, you know, buy a frying pan. And that just blew me away at how practical a suggestion it was. You know, Tupperware containers, frying pan, the bus pass. You know, there's some real ways that people
Brooms
can help.
And mops.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Everybody just goes straight to tinned food as the way to help people. And that's...
Sorry, everyone goes straight to where?
Tinned food.
Like a can of beans or...
Yeah. Non-perishable food
items. Okay, tinned food. Okay.
Anyway, but we'll have somebody.
Refugees also need something to dust the shelves with. You
this
know?
Is true. Yeah. Feather dusters. Mm-hmm. I will buy feather dusters for refugees. That's
wooden spoons.
Well, I mean, I will say, and probably my colleague at Capital Room will talk about this too, but Canada is quite unique in that we are the only country with a permanent private sponsorship program in place. And I mean, this is really great, not only because, you know, I think for us as an, you know, as an LGBT community, you know, many of us, you know, have still suffered discrimination or still understand the discomfort of having to, you know, disclose who you truly are. And even though Canada does have a solid reputation for sexual and gender equality, you know, it's by no means perfect. No place is perfect. But to be able to make a meaningful, tangible difference, not only in the lives of the refugees, but in our lives as a community, I think is just incomparable. So,
absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
We'll let you go, but we'll wrap up the show in just a couple more seconds. Thank you so much, and hopefully you'll tune into the other episodes in our series.
Okay. Thanks so much, guys. Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye. That was Nicholas Hirsch, an immigration lawyer here based out of Ottawa with very substantial experience. He mentioned the guidelines earlier that the UN have. What he failed to mention was that he worked on them whilst working with UNHCR in Morocco.
He co-authored them.
Well, I don't know if it was to that extent, but he certainly was working on them in Morocco. Whilst working for UNHCR. So, yes.
Oh, yeah, this is why we were talking about Morocco last time.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was after the show, anyway. And I mentioned the beatniks, and it was just this very strange thing that you have. From a legal point of view, historically, Morocco has not been very LGBT-friendly, but from a cultural point of view, it has been. It's one of those sort of don't ask, don't tell sort of situations where so long as you don't shout it from the mountaintops, nobody cares and you largely get left alone, which is why in the 50s, all the beatniks moved to Morocco. Allen Ginsberg and William S. Burroughs both said they had more sex in Morocco than basically the rest of their life all put together. Well, it's just how you navigate daily life and how you deal with the police. And then you have other places where there are legal protections in place, but whether or not they're actually observed. So I have quite a few friends from Turkey, actually, who've pointed out that there is something on the books in Turkey that gives legal protection to LGBT folk, but it's very poorly enforced. Mm. And it depends on where you live in the country as to whether or not the culture is supportive of you and whether or not the police, local police, have it in themselves as individuals to actually care about some of those laws. And so it's really mixed all over the world. And it's the culture and the law doesn't always line up.
Absolutely. Now, the guidelines for the UN are that I mentioned earlier were about how to engage with LGBT folks in countries where same-sex relationships are criminalized.
They're criminalized, okay.
Yes. So I'm not sure if at the time it was in Morocco. We'll have to do a little bit of digging and find out that.
That was Morocco in the 50s I was talking about. I have not heard an update on the legal system. I'm a little bit dated.
Yeah, yeah. You have a 60-year-old, legal
understanding,
suggestion.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, we might need to.
You know
Google
what,
though?
That. I fessed up to it. So that's.
You did.
That's 80% of the problem.
Was confessing you haven't had an
off the table, yeah.
For 60 years. Wow. That's ridiculous. Next week, we will be talking to somebody from Human Rights Watch about what kind of forces people out the door. Now, I am also, because you mentioned about fessing up, I am going to fess up that we have not reached out to any refugees during Refugee Month. And somebody might flag that up as, why the heck not? Why wouldn't you reach out to refugees?
Well, putting a refugee on air has its own mixed bag of ethical mm-hmm. issues.
And I think Nick, in the conversation today, really, really well demonstrated why we've made the editorial decision not to. Because you don't want to drag somebody back through that.
Mm-hmm.
And also to shine a giant spotlight on them would be in many ways unfair.
Yeah.
We are, of course, open to folks who maybe if you're listening now and you are refugees and you want to share your experience with us, certainly let us know. Tweet us at VelvetStudio1 or find us on the website, www.velvetstudio.ca. But if you're tuning every week thinking, like, gosh, they haven't even spoken to one yet, we just don't want to put that kind of...
Well, we have, just not on air. Actually,
absolutely.
I know a few refugees.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's important to kind of acknowledge that.
Yeah.
Acknowledge that That was the approach that we thought would be most appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
Next week, we are also talking about a very, very sensitive topic. It's what drives people to become a refugee. Now, of course, everyone's familiar with, you know, ISIS and their constant beheading and dropping from a great height of homosexual men.
Yeah.
They recently, just last month, killed another two, one of whom was a member of ISIS, which is interesting. Because there was a lot of rumors coming out that ISIS was tolerating homosexuality amongst its ranks, but was using it as a tool or a fig leaf for punishment against people that they were ruling over, which is interesting that there was this kind of double standard. But it seems like even now that has given way.
Very peculiar.
Yeah, I know, for people who follow ISIS.
Yeah.
Like the stories, not, you know. Anyway.
We don't really talk about Russia anymore.
We don't.
Yeah.
Things have quieted down a little bit in Russia.
Well, the news on Russia has quieted down. That doesn't mean the actual situation has quieted
down.
This
is true.
This is one of the problems about coverage. So, for example, I think it was about a month ago when the floods in the Louisiana Plains began. Because the Mississippi rose something like 3 inches, but because the shores are so incredibly shallow, 3 inches up, that's like a kilometer in land, and just so many people were displaced. Yeah. But it wasn't in the news, and so therefore it wasn't really a hot topic. And there's all sorts of things that are still happening now that are just not in the news, and so they're not a hot topic. It depends on what news sources you watch as to whether or not you even know something is happening anymore. For all we know, it's worse in Russia than ever.
If you think you know something that we should be talking about, let us know. We're planning on next programming.
And feel free to link articles as well. We will read them.
Yeah, we absolutely will. Let us know. Anyways, we're playing out with Kota Peret's Ocean's Brawl. I chose this one because I can pronounce the song.
But not the name of the man.
Anyways, we'll be back next week talking about, and a bit of a warning, we are talking about forced anal examinations and other push factors for refugee claimants as well. And that's all for now. Thank you so much. Bye-bye. No goodbye from you, Sebastian.
Oh, yes, goodbye. Thank you for listening. I am Sebastian.
To hail and saw what was left down there and more. Hide and seek for far too long. Kept my treasures with my bones. Lived for lies, lived for tales. Lived for good and hit the rails. Love you, boy, with what I know. Hit that love with my bones. Don't need